Ms. Cheney, you're up first.
Good morning. May it please the court. The ALJ's decision was not based on substantial evidence in the record as a whole. First, the overwhelming medical evidence makes the ALJ's decision untenable. Second, listing 1.04A was met at step 3. Third, the ALJ should have questioned the VE. The ALJ's decision should be reversed and benefits awarded. Royce Glenn McDade is an obese diabetic who hobbles around his house on two crutches. He has to change his underwear several times a day due to a draining anal fistula. He has COPD and chronic heart problems. He had a car wreck in 2007 that injured his cervical and lumbar spine, leaving him with a cervical impairment rating of 25 to 28% and a lumbar impairment rating of 17 to 20%. He also had a documented brain injury from that car wreck that ruined his vision, concentration, and memory.
Are you saying he had a listing at step 3?
Yes, Your Honor.
At listing 1.04?
A, yes,
1.04A. 1.04A, okay. Explain that. Why do you think that he fits that?
Sure. I'll talk about the MRI from Dr. Harshfield, and he's the board-certified radiologist who was the expert in reading the MRI. And the MRI showed that he met the four elements of the listing, and the four elements are nerve root compression, neuroanatomic distribution of pain, motor loss, sensory reflex loss, and positive straight leg raise. The MRI showed...
What medicals? You just named a doctor. I was...
Sure. Dr. Harshfield, and his MRI is at...
When was it done, and was it part of the administrative record?
Yes, Your Honor.
It wasn't just submitted to the Appeals Council, or was it?
No. It was part of the record. It was at page 521 of the record, done in May 2008, before the 2009 hearing. And Dr. Harshfield found at four cervical levels foraminal narrowing, which is compression of the nerve roots. It's when the hole at the bottom of the vertebrae, which is the foramen, narrows and compresses on those nerve roots. So that's nerve root compression, one of the listings. He also found, there was also an MRI that showed lumbar foraminal disc displacement, which is, again, pressing down on the nerve roots at the foramen. And those two conditions of nerve root compression cause a neuroanatomic distribution of pain throughout the body. And we know that because Dr. Tucker, the neurologist, diagnosed that neuroanatomic distribution of pain by doing clinical tests in his office on sensory, motor, and reflex loss, which is another listing in 1.04A. And he found deficits in the hamstrings, quadriceps, hip flexors, forearms, and fingers. That's the extremity pain caused by the nerve root compression. And that extremity pain is what causes Glenn to walk around on two crutches and feel like, in his words, he's hanging from a meat hook. How can somebody with those impairments do the occasional standing and walking required?
Well, I'm kind of concerned, and maybe this is what Judge Loken was asking about. Tell me whether this was directly or clearly raised in the district court or in the before the IJ.
Sure. We raised the listing argument perhaps inarticulately, but we raised it in the district court. And the administration...
Well, how? I mean, don't just say inarticulate. How?
Well, we raised that the combination of impairments were severe enough to find an awarding of disability.
Well, that's not a step three argument.
Well, we feel that we...
Well, in the broad sense, but... If I was the district court, I would view that as raising a step three issue that I don't think the ALJ much discussed.
Well, we know that the administration conceded we raised that issue because at page one of their brief they said it's a listing argument, and so they understood that we were raising a listing argument. I didn't brief it as articulately as I should have. The Whitney case from 2012 says that if raised at all at the district court,
well,
even
when I looked at it, the only place I want you to correct me if I'm wrong,
sure,
that I thought that maybe you raised it was on your motion for reconsideration. which and even there it's not real clear, but tell me why, whether or not it was raised clearly there, and that could be too late.
Right.
Or how did you raise it before that?
Well, I do believe there's case law that says, and I believe it was the Cromines case, that says that raising even in a reply or a motion for reconsideration is not late. The judge has it in front of him and has an opportunity to address it. And we did talk in detail in that reconsideration brief about the cervical problems, the impairments in the spine, which is what I'm talking about meeting here, the disorders of the spine listing 1.04A. So, again, we raised it. It was briefed more thoroughly at the Eighth Circuit, and the fact that they responded at the Eighth Circuit and briefed it and countered it in detail means that they waived the waiver argument. I'll also get to more overwhelming objective
evidence.
Was
it argued in the Appeals Council?
Was it? No, it was not. I'll get to, okay.
Let me stop you there, because I don't know the answer to this. If you don't raise it at the Appeals Council, is it waived then when you go on from there?
I do not know that answer. I do not know. I just know about the district court, raising it in the district court, and that it's not waived. And the fact also from the Cromines case, it says that if the district judge does not address the issue in his ruling at the district court, then it is not deemed a waiver. So we believe that Listing's argument is valid here. The overwhelming medical evidence, we have four doctors that saw Glenn McDade 195 times and have hundreds of pages of notes in the records, objective evidence based on testing. The ALJ decided instead to believe only Dr. Haygood, the family doctor who Glenn saw 11 times, and Haygood only had 5 pages of notes in the 800-page record. Haygood himself believed in Glenn's pain, his chronic pain. He prescribed on 13 occasions Lorset, Darvocet, and Tramadol. That's medication for people with chronic pain. Those are narcotics, and they argued he didn't take narcotics. Well, he did. And let's look next at the fact that Haygood did a straight leg raise test in his office, and that's the last element of listing 1.04 raise. If it's positive and it was positive for lumbar pain, then you've met the listing. So I would like to argue that we have met that listing. Let's talk again now about the weight, the overwhelming weight, the overwhelming evidence we have from the four other doctors. First, Clary. Now, he's a chiropractor. He saw Glenn 168 times, and he did x-rays of the cervical and lumbar spine, and he found those impairment ratings I discussed earlier. And he was important because Dr. Haygood himself, the doctor that the judge relied on, referred to Clary for chiropractic care and treatment. He referred Glenn out. He referred him out to all those doctors. In fact, when Glenn came in and said, "I need you to help me fill out the Social Security paperwork," Haygood said, "I'm not the expert here. They're the experts. They're the ones that have the opinions. You need to get them to fill out your paperwork." He referred him to Hirsch for medications. He referred him to Harshfield for the MRI, to Tucker for neurology, and to Hirsch for family practice. So Clary should have been considered, and he wasn't given weight at all. Next, I would have...
Well, he shouldn't be considered as an acceptable medical source.
Well, he is... You're correct there, Your Honor. He is a non-acceptable...
He can provide useful evidence.
Right.
But he's not a treating physician.
He's a doctor. He's a
chiropractor.
Doctor of chiropractic.
Well, that's not an MD, right?
It's not an MD. He's not an acceptable medical source. I agree, but he's allowed to give opinions on the severity.
Is he a treating physician from the standpoint in the context of the Eighth Circuit's many cases on the opinions of the weight that needs to be given to treating physician opinions?
Yes, he is. The Sloan case showed that a chiropractor, a non-acceptable medical source who treats the patient, and he treated him 168 times, may be given more weight than an acceptable treating physician, medical source. And he may give an opinion on the combination of impairments, which Clary did the impairment ratings, and the ability to work. And Clary, in two letters, said he's not able to work.
Well, the ALJ discounted it. It was not persuasive, and partly because he was giving some disability conclusions, but the ALJ didn't say, but Dr. Clary was kind of extending himself. He was giving some opinions on brain injury, which is way outside of his field. I mean, a chiropractor, at least I've never heard of a chiropractor giving opinions on brain injury. So I think that may have discounted his credibility when he went so far afield. You correct me if I'm wrong there.
Well, what he did is review the MRI, and he found the brain injury in the MRI. The Chiari zero condition, which is at the craniovertebral junction, that's where after traumatic injury the brain is pulled down into the hole at the base of the skull, and that causes the numbness, tingling, pain, headaches, memory loss. That's all documented in the record. So there was a brain injury. In fact, Dr. Hurst referred to the MRI and found an abnormal brain MRI. She concluded that specifically, and I have that.
I don't see a Sloan in your table of authorities.
The Sloan is from the 28J letter that we submitted about 2 weeks ago. It's the new authority on the non-acceptable medical source. Well, in fact, Sloan also says that non-acceptable source should be considered based on a few factors. One is how often he's seen the patient, 168 times versus 11 from Haygood, and his specialty in that area, and his more detailed conclusions about the condition.
Sloan is what year?
Sloan is 2007, I believe. I can let you know that on rebuttal.
Eighth Circuit,
yes.
Well, let me ask you this. You haven't touched on the argument that I thought would be maybe you would lead off with or would be perhaps one of your key assertions here, and that is the fact that the ALJ received testimony from the vocational expert, but it was very brief, and it simply was an opinion as to the exertional level of particular employment, and it was not the typical kind of VE opinion. And instead, the ALJ relied on the grids. And that's kind of unusual to me. Typically, there's some kind of non-exertional factor that comes into play that requires a vocational expert. So I wanted you, before you run out of your time, do you think that's a significant issue?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And we think that's a very important procedural misstep by the ALJ. There are several cases that we cited that are on all fours. One of them is Draper. And Draper was not considered at all or discussed by the administration. So perhaps that means they concede Draper. Draper, she had lumbar injury and chronic pain. She had the same limitations, almost verbatim, as Glenn McDade has in terms of walking, standing, sitting, that sort of thing. What she did do, she was able to watch TV, visit with friends, pay her bills, some of the activities of daily living that Glenn himself could do. And the court in that case, the Eighth Circuit, held that those activities alone are not evidence a claimant can work day in and day out in the stressful and competitive work environment.
What's distinguishable about Draper is that the panel found a flaw in the ALJ's analysis. It recited the law consistent with what the ALJ and the magistrate judge and the agency says the law is here, which is, I mean, if you've got a residual function, a finding of an RFC that you can do the full range of sedentary work, you don't need a VE to testify as to what jobs are available.
And I believe the ALJ discredited the subjective complaints of pain and the medical evidence.
I understand that, but Draper doesn't. I don't understand why. I mean, you can attack the RFC finding, and you are. But if the finding is good, then the use of the grids is good, right?
Certainly. And we, that's exactly what we're doing, okay, is attacking the RFC finding and saying he could do the work just like Draper. He couldn't do the sedentary work just like Draper. And the fact that she could do those activities, you know, many ALJs rely on that and say, well, look, she could perhaps do light housework. She could visit with friends, get on the computer, just like McDade. And that is not evidence that they can have the residual functioning capacity to work a job. So that was Draper, and we believe that case is very instructive here. and that the VE should have been questioned. That case, they reversed the ALJ. Then there's the O'Leary case, similar impairments, back injury, but only a 15% impairment rating. We know we have impairment ratings here of 17 to 20% and 25 to 28%, so significantly more than the case O'Leary case. And there were no psychological issues in O'Leary, and here we have Glenn treated for depression with Prozac. The ALJ should have questioned the VE and was reversed. And the final case is Thompson, and we cited that in our 28J letter. And there was back pain treated on a weekly basis, just like in McDade. And multiple doctors found he had a severe impairment and couldn't work based on his back injury. The ALJ relied on one and only one consulting physician. Now, remember, he relied on Haygood primarily here, who had 5 pages of notes in the entire record. And in Thompson, the ALJ relied on that one doctor and didn't consider the fact that the other doctors said severe impairment, cannot work, and so he was reversed for not having substantial evidence to support his decision. And I'll tell you again that Haygood, in spite of having his findings that contradicted the other doctor, he said minor abnormalities, not much going on here, 5 pages of notes. He believed Glenn had credible pain. He believed that he...
Your time's expired.
I will. I'll sit down. Thank you.
Am I right that these impairment ratings, these percentage ratings, that's from the workers' compensation world?
It's actually from the AMA guides, which is used in worker compensation. The AMA guides is the authority.
I'm not familiar with its regular use in Social Security disability.
Well, and actually the listings, 1.00G, cite specifically
I just wanted the clarification.
Sure. I'm sorry. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Is it Mr. Seema?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Hopefully I pronounced that right. Good morning.
Yes, Your Honor, you did. Good morning. My name is Brock Seema, and I represent the Commissioner of Social Security in this matter, and may it please the Court. In finding that Mr. McDade was limited to only performing the full range of sedentary work, the ALJ properly took into account Mr. McDade's subjective allegations of pain and also properly took into account the entire medical record. I'd like to first address the ALJ's credibility finding in this.
Would you just take a moment and tell me what your client's view of these percentage impairment ratings is? What significance they have in this disability analysis?
Our position is that they are of very limited significance, and that the ALJ may consider those AMA findings overall in the record and make it as part of the whole picture, but they're really completely different than the disability regulations that the Social Security has.
Now, is that part of, I'm not that familiar with this area, but there's all kinds of law that says when a doctor says disability, that doesn't, while that may be considered, it does not necessarily coincide with the Social Security regulations of disability. Now, is that what you're saying here? Is that the AMA's disability ratings, which we all use as trial lawyers in personal injury cases, that has a different basis or comes to maybe a little different conclusion than what the Social Security regulations do?
Yes, Your Honor, that is exactly.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor, that is exactly what we're saying, is that there's a different conclusion. And, in fact, this Court has repeatedly held that the a disability finding by a physician is actually an opinion reserved to the commissioner, and the disability regulations for Social Security disability are different than the AMA guidelines or workers' compensation guidelines or any other guidelines that a physician may look at. Now, regarding the credibility finding that the ALJ found, the commissioner's position is that the ALJ made a well-supported credibility determination. And this is important because in making a well-supported credibility determination and properly discounting Mr. McDade's subjective allegations of pain, the ALJ then properly relied on the grids in finding that plaintiff could only perform sedentary work. Now, Mr. McDade's argument that there's a lot of medical evidence out there, and this medical evidence shows that he had pain and that he had issues, the commissioner is not saying that Mr. McDade did not have any of these issues, did not have impairments. He found that he had severe impairments, found that they affected his ability to work, but he took that all into account in limiting him to the lowest exertional level of work, which is sedentary work. Not all pain is disabling. Not all injuries are disabling. And in this instance, the ALJ relied on four well-supported reasons for discounting Mr. McDade's credibility.
Well, he started out by dismissing all impairments other than back pain, obesity, and diabetes, didn't he?
Well, he looked at those as
those are the only severe impairments.
Severe impairments, yes, Your Honor.
I'm not sure to what extent he took the other factors or medical issues into account.
Well, the ALJ stated in his opinion that he's required to look at all impairments and all combinations of impairments, those that are severe and those that are not severe as well.
Let's go to this issue, the step three issue of the 1.04A listing. First, from a perspective of whether you believe it's properly before the court or whether it was waived at some point in the process. And then if we should find it's not waived, what is your answer directly on the merits? Let's start first about whether you think it's an issue here.
Yes, Your Honor. Our position and the position in our brief to this court, first and foremost, is that the issue was waived. The issue was waived because it was not brought up at the district court level. In their reply brief to this court, they stated that they brought it up in the motion for reconsideration on pages 50 to 52 of the appendix. Looking at pages 50 to 52 of the appendix has nothing to do with an argument regarding the listings. It's under the subheading chiropractor evidence. And the argument is that Mr. Clary, the chiropractor's opinion, should be given more weight. They don't cite any specific listing. They don't state with any specificity why he meets a particular listing. And moreover, in their argument, they don't cite to a listing in their appellant brief. Specifically, 1.04A was a listing brought up by the commissioner in trying to make an alternative argument stating that if the issue isn't waived, they also didn't meet this listing. Mr. McDade brought up introductory paragraph as a listing, which isn't a listing, and also brought up listing 1.05C, which has to do with amputation, which the commissioner suspected was a mistake.
Was it raised before the appeals council?
No, Your Honor, it was not.
And what's the law on that, whether that's preserved or not? Or is there any law?
There's no law that I know of regarding whether at the appeals council if it was waived or not. But in their brief, Mr. McDade cites to Seventh Circuit case law that states that a motion for reconsideration is sufficient, but the Eighth Circuit position has been that it's not sufficient to be raised in a motion for reconsideration.
What about on the merits? Does this fall under Step 3, 1.04A, and why not?
No, it does not fall under 1.04A because there wasn't sufficient evidence of nerve root compression, sensory loss, reflex loss was the argument we put forth in our brief. Now, Mr. McDade has cited to some evidence that refers to that, but the evidence clearly shows, and mostly looking at Dr. Haygood's interpretation of the MRIs, of his cervical spine, of his lumbar spine, of his brain, Dr. Haygood basically stated that he didn't see any reason or any abnormalities in those MRIs that would explain Mr. McDade's allegations of pain.
Did the agency level before the ALJ's proceeding, did those consulting physicians have the MRI result? Because I think the ALJ referred to them in his paragraph on.
Yes, Your Honor. the ALJ did refer to the MRIs and specifically based his credibility finding on the results of those MRIs, specifically looked to the diagnostic testing, which I think lends even more credibility to the ALJ's finding in this regard.
Sometimes the administration sends interrogatory or questionnaire like forms to treating physicians that ask them, you know, how long can this person sit, stand, you know, this kind of thing. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are any of those, I don't recall, at least I didn't see anything like that in this record.
No, Your Honor. The ALJ's opinion was that there was sufficient medical evidence in the record to make a decision. Those reports are sent out when the ALJ feels like there's an issue that needs to be further developed in making his decision. And here, the ALJ had sufficient medical records to make a determination that Mr. McDade could perform only sedentary work. And this court has held that the ALJ is only required to, recontact a physician or to more develop the record when there's an issue that hasn't been fully brought out in the records. And here we're dealing with an 800-page transcript that's full of medical records that the ALJ could rely on in reaching his decision. Thus, on the issue of the grids that Judge Shepard raised, I wanted to touch on the Thompson case and the Draper case that Mr. McDade has relied upon. And in those instances, those cases were distinguishable from this case in that in those cases, this court remanded because the ALJ did not make a well-supported credibility determination. And here the ALJ did make a well-supported credibility determination. Thus, when there are no exertional or non-exertional impairments that erode the claimant's ability to perform the full range of sedentary work, he can rely on the grids. And here, in looking at the objective medical evidence and looking at the fact that looking at Mr. McDade's daily activities, looking at the fact that he didn't take any narcotic pain medication on a long-term basis, looking at the fact that his conditions were amenable to treatment, the ALJ made a well-supported credibility determination and therefore properly relied on the grids. If there are no further questions, I don't have anything further.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you,
Mr. Seaman. I believe Ms. Cheney's time is up, but if you have something burning to tell us to correct what Mr. Seaman said, I'll give you 1 minute.
I just want to refer again to Judge Loken's questions about the AMA guides. They are not direct evidence of disability, and we're not arguing that. They are part of the picture as a whole and taken with doctors' records and clinical testing and subjective complaints. They may be used to create an impairment rating. And Social Security cases, we're talking about a combination of impairments. So I would argue they should be considered. That's new Eighth Circuit law that would be created to consider them. But it seems that why would the court need to reinvent the wheel every time we have an impairment case or a back injury case? Just because we already have the book that's the authority on impairment ratings. So that's all I would say.
Well, I've had a little experience, not in the Social Security area, but in the personal injury area. And I know that what doctors talk about impairment, lawyers talk about disability, and they're not talking about the same thing. And so I can understand why there'd be a whole third line of authority being the Social Security, because it's not even consistent within the personal injury area. So, anyway, thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you.
And thank you both, and we'll be back to you as soon as we can. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.